At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. We are proud partners with Politicon. Follow with Politicon on all social media and go to politicon.com for show notes on this episode and more great political content. We also are proud to have a new sponsor, Magic Spoon. It is magical cereal. We'll tell you more about it later. Thanks to all of you for listening today. Tell your friends. Remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast. James, I must tell you that I went last night and I was writing about this presidential debate for The Hill. And as I began, I got bash envy. That's as in CNN's Dana Bash, who called that debate last night a shit show. And I just wish I could have said that. I mean, Trump, who has nothing to say substantively, wanted to disrupt and rattle Biden. He succeeded in disrupting, but with one or two exceptions, he didn't rattle Joe Biden. The vice president got a couple things wrong, like the trade deficit, but on most stuff, especially COVID-19, number of Americans with pre-existing conditions, Trump was on his heels. And he got off the hook on his personal tax scandals, revealed by the New York Times. He just stonewalled it. That will not go away. And just finally, nobody wins a debate like this. It was a god-awful night, but Trump lost. He is clearly behind, and he needed something approaching a game changer. He didn't come close to getting it. The vice president has reason to be pleased. He went in ahead, did nothing to hurt himself, and is ahead today, perhaps even by a little more.
Yeah, I have a little more of an optimistic view. I actually think Biden helped himself. I mean, people had doubts about Biden. And this were not just one focus group, but overwhelmingly people were concerned about his age. Were concerned about, having the left having too much influence, et cetera, et cetera. And I thought he went in and had some work to do. And actually, what I'm scared of is that Trump chased all the audience away. But I wish the more people I stayed and watched that debate, actually the better I would feel. I think Biden was significantly better than adequate. And people do have doubts about his age. And he was as sharp as he was when he was in his 50s. I mean, he had pretty good command of the facts. He's not the greatest debate in the world. No one expected that. But my take is he did better than people were giving him credit for. I mean, Trump is just overwhelmed, as you can imagine, the entire coverage. And the Trump part of the debate was a shit show. Biden, actually conducted himself with admirable deportment, I thought.
I actually agree. I just think the only reason he might not get all the credit, he's happy today. But it was so debased by Trump. It was so demeaned that it's kind of hard for anyone to be but repulsed by the whole thing. The moderator lost control. It was chaotic. It went beyond. It was just the worst debate that's ever been held. And I'll just say one more thing. There have been suggestions by so-called pundits like Joe Scarborough that Biden ought to refuse subsequent debates. That's insane. That's what Trump wants him to do. I'm sorry. He did fine last night, and Trump is never going to do any better.
Right, but I get to actually think, John Harris, and I like John, but the whole thing was just a mess. People just, no, it was not. It was only his portion. And I look at the headlines, and the sort of clever thing to say is, oh, the whole thing was a damn mess. And, it's just the American politics. His part was. And Chris Wallace lost control of it. I don't know what the guy could have done.
I know what Tim Russert would have done. Tim Russert would have said after 10 or 15 minutes, wait a minute, we have rules. And if you're not going to abide by the rules, What I'm going to do is we're going to change the rules and I'll cut off your mic while the other person is talking. Look, I think Joe Biden did just fine. It's something called Gresham's Law. And that is that it just brings down everything. It didn't hurt Joe Biden, but it was hard to say, God, I love watching Joe Biden last night, because the whole thing was, as Dana said, a shit show because of Trump.
I understand that. I actually, you look at the contrast, you know, of course, I'm looking at some people emailing me and texting me like focus group, but people use the terms. And I actually... I don't think Trump did terribly and brought Biden down to a level.
I'm not saying that. Yeah.
I wish they'd debate five more times.
Yeah, I agree.
I had to watch it because I had to do television after. There's no way I would have stayed and watched that debate after the first half hour.
Well, that's what I mean. You're exactly right. And that had nothing to do with Joe Biden.
No.
He was doing fine. No. I that's absolutely right. You know, there are a couple of things that we can't let pass, too. And that is that when he his message to that right wing militia group, the Proud Boys, Trump's message was load and lock for November 4. I mean, that just chills went down my back. He is encouraging people to be violent. It was appalling that a president of the United States would say something like that.
So that is OK. That is coded language he used for the next week's show. And I think the Southern Poverty Law Center is good on this. We need to get someone that studies these extremist groups.
Right.
All right. Because Trump was sending them language. Now, I'm just going to give you my theory. It's out there. But I think last night just gave me more confidence I'm right. He knows that he is not going to win the election on any kind of legitimate basis. And he also knows that he is in massive legal jeopardy. Even if the new attorney general just took the Mueller report, the obstruction charges would be a very, very difficult case for Trump to defend that. Don't even mention the New York DA, the New York AG, the Manhattan DA. And I think he wants to keep these people close to him. And you notice he also singled out Philadelphia. And they're going to try to delegitimize, and of course, Philadelphia, you grew up in the Philadelphia area. City of Philadelphia is kind of code for African Americans. And they are going to try to say that the whole thing was illegitimate, it was crooked, and we're not going anywhere, we're not going to accept this. And these people will be out in the streets and, defending him. And he'll say, it'll all go away if I get a pardon. I actually believe this is part of a survival strategy on his part, because there's nothing that anyone saw last night where you said to yourself, this guy is trying to win this election. No. And like Tim Scott said, well, it would be terrible if he doesn't clarify this. He's not going to clarify. He's not going to clarify the QAnon stuff. In his back of his mind, he thinks that he can form some kind of personal militia to save his legal skin and his family skin. That I think is behind all of this. And it's the only explanation that I can come up with to explain what happened last night.
I would have dismissed that a couple of weeks ago, but I think it's very hard to dismiss now. And, Senator Scott said the same thing after Charlottesville. I mean, at some point, Senator Scott, you're going to realize that he's not going to clarify it because he has clarified it. It's what he believes. He's a racist. He wants to play the race card. He wants to turn Americans against one another. He wants to incite violence if he needs to save his own ass. And that's just a fact of life.
Well, I would say he does. Right. He says racist things. He compliments racist groups. All right. His history is certainly one with more than just flirtation with racism. But
right.
I don't know if he uses it to exploit things for his own personal good, or that he genuinely believes that. I would suspect it's both. But right now, he's using that because he feels like he has to have a real core of support that will protect him from going to the penitentiary. It's where he's going. We could get any tax lawyer to tell you with all of the potential criminal violations that they have in these tax returns. They're not just like, fine, well, you deducted some bill here. You should, you went with Judy on a trip and you took that off your, that's not what we're dealing with here. I mean, we're dealing with massive, massive. And, you know, and we know for a fact that the Manhattan DA is highly competent and has a very, very deep investigation. And Trump knows that. Right. And Trump knows the New York State authorities and knows he, the new attorney general will not be named Bill Barr. I promise you that. And this guy is trying to stay out of jail because that's where he's going. And you look at the Brad Parcell thing, they have rifled through and stolen God knows how many tens of hundreds of millions of dollars in that campaign. And it's all going to come out. It just is. There's no stopping it.
Well, on that note, I agree. It would be really good to get one of those experts on those hate groups on right. in the next week or two. But also, let's go get Andrew Weissman on. His book is out, and we can talk about the book. But he also can talk about, how prosecutable Trump and his family might be next January. And I think he knows that pretty well.
Got to get Andrew Weissman, and we got to get an expert on these kind of fringe hate groups.
Right.
Because there is something that language about block and standby, that is language that they use. He didn't just happen to come up with that. And, he's always talked about my people can get, they play nice, but they're not playing nice anymore. He is going to try to disrupt this thing. I've run this theory by several people. And, half of them say, if that's what it takes to get him out of there, James, shit, just let him go. All right? Just let him go to Mar-a-Lago and do his show. I just can't take this anymore. And he's counting on that. He's counting on that. And, and you're saying, well, if you prosecute him, you're just going to keep the country divided. It's going to be a big mess. Sometimes, discretion is the better part of prosecution. And it's just better to let it go. You're going to hear that argument a lot. And you've got to admit that it is somewhat attractive.
Well, I would say it's somewhat attractive with a caveat, going back to the time when Ford and pardoned Nixon, which was absolutely the right thing to do. The one mistake Ford made was he did not get an admission of guilt. And I think if this guy needs a pardon of any sort, the prerequisite ought to be an admission of guilt. And if he's not willing to do that, no pardon.
I could change, but I'm a little bit harder ass. I think that in the words of Senator Gary, him and his whole fucking family need to go to jail.
Well, I'm not disagreeing. I'm saying if you give him a pardon, there's only way you do it is if you get an admission of guilt. That's all I'm saying. I think I'm closer to your view. I want to see him in an orange jumpsuit.
We're not that far apart, but the point is we can both see we kind of agree. We can both see it coming to where you're going to have to make a judgment. If he says, I want to go to Mar-a-Lago. I want to do Trump TV. I'll sign anything. I'll do anything.
Right. Let me just say a final point, which I was disappointed it was not asked last night. I mean, I think the biggest bombshell in that New York Times tax story wasn't that he didn't pay, but, taxes for 10 years and $750 for a couple of years. I mean, we sort of guessed that. But the biggest thing is he is so in debt. This is a man who is on the brink of potential financial ruin. He really needs that, and that is a huge issue for him going ahead.
Huh, is it? The big trouble he's got too is his whole idiot family. Remember, Eric has to testify on October 7th. I cannot begin to tell you how prepared those prosecutors are going to be. And they will throw, he's still sitting out there with Bannon. You forget. Bannon's got he's in serious and profound legal jeopardy. Obviously, Brad Parcell is in serious and profound legal jeopardy. And neither one of those going to stand up and not try to get out of going to the penitentiary. Trump is in deep, deep legal jeopardy on every front, and he knows it. He knows it.
And Bob Woodward made the very good point that the only thing that saves him is there's no John Dean, but there are John Dean wannabes out there. You just named two of them.
These people in New York, these are not Robert Mueller. They're not gonna give him written interrogatory.
Right.
All right. It's just not gonna happen. And but again, the interesting thing is they're gonna have to make a choice at some point. And that's what Trump is doing. He builds up a personal militia, a group of people that are loyal to him. And he don't trust General Dempsey or Admiral whoever, he thinks
Milley, right.
Milley. That's not what he's looking for. He wants some people with some chains in the street. And that's exactly the signal that he's sending off. People need to see this for what it is. This is a effort not to win the election, because there's nothing that he did last night. If you go in and you'll say he's 6 points down. I think he's more than 6 points down, but let's just say 6 points down, because that's the most conservative figure you can come up with. He wasn't even trying to close the gap at all. He wasn't trying to convince anybody. He was trying to dig as deep down into this kind of weird conspiracy, Proud Boys, QAnon, God knows, groups that you can imagine. And he was quite blatant about signaling that. And that's the only explanation. Now, I'd be open to another explanation, but I don't think there is one.
Well, subtly is not his bag. But I'll tell you who else is going to make a choice, James. And that is a lot of people in the Buckeye State, which we thought was turning red, but maybe it's turning back purple. And we have a guest who can really, really tell us about that. This episode is brought to you by Magic Spoon.
Well, I tell you what happened, Albert. I go and look at the mail, and I got this box. And they open it up, it's four different kinds of cereal. And I'm like, well, this is nice. I wonder who, sent me this. And so my wife comes in and says, honey, where did you get this stuff? This stuff is really good. I've been eating cereal all my life, and all that crap tastes like cornflakes to me. But I eat it sometimes because it's easy, and, I can read the paper in the morning and drink coffee and eat cereal. I actually look forward to breakfast. I'm not kidding you.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. My wife teases me that I gravitate to anything that's unhealthy. But this cereal is healthy, and I really do love it. But let me tell you something much more important, and that is our 2.5-year-old grandchild, Kai. I took it out to see what he thought of it, and he said he likes it as much as vanilla ice cream, which he devours. So if I can like it, Kai can like it, and my daughter, who hasn't agreed on anything since I gave her a college graduation present, also loves it. Man, that's a trilogy. We'll take it.
Yeah, and I'm not a health food guy at all. This crap is good. I tell you, I was impressed with it, and I can, read the morning paper and scream at Trump and spit out the magic spoon.
Well, they've got cocoa, fruity, frosted, and blueberry.
Yeah, but blueberry is the best, I think.
Well, I think Kai likes cocoa because it, and now he won't say this, as bright as he is, because it's got no sugar, 11 grams of protein, and only 3 net carbs. That's just like the other varieties. I mean, that's the kind of stuff I never ate before.
Yeah, I know the 14 beers I drink every day have carbs, I think. But
I think I'd have Magic Spoon before you get to the beer.
So go to magicspoon.com/warroom to grab a variety pack and try it today. And be sure to use our promo code WARROOM, that's all one word, at checkout to get free shipping. Now, Magic Spoon, it really tastes amazing. It honestly is too good to be true. It's keto-friendly, gluten-free, grain-free, soy-free, low-carb, and GMO-free. Delicious. Try it. Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it, for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. That's magicspoon.com/warroom and use the code WARROOM, all one word, for free shipping. We thank Magic Spoon for sponsoring this podcast.
James, Ohio is the state of presidents, they used to say. It's certainly the state where you win the presidency. The Buckeyes voted for the winner of the presidential election 17, I think, of the last 18 elections. No Republican has ever captured the White House without taking Ohio. Clinton, Obama won it twice, but Trump trounced Hillary Clinton by 8 points 4 years ago. And then in an otherwise good year, the Democrats suffered setbacks in Ohio in 2018. So I assume the Buckeye State was going the way of Missouri, from purple to red. But Joe Biden says he's going to win. And a Fox poll last week, that's a good poll, by the way, had the Democrats up 5. Monkey Survey had Trump up 4. But the great Charlie Cook says it's now a toss-up. We have someone who can answer that question today, who knows Ohio inside out, Michael Coleman, the mayor of Columbus, Ohio. For 16 years, he did an extraordinary job just in transforming that city, and he's run statewide. Mr. Mayor, thank you for joining us.
Well, good to be here with you, and I'm excited about being with the Raging Cajun.
Tell me this, does Joe Biden really have a chance, or assess his chances in Ohio right now?
Well, I do believe that Ohio is a toss-up. I think Joe Biden can win. He are certain things he's going to have to do to win Ohio. It is a state that is gone from purple to red, but I think because of, for many reasons, it's gone back to purple. And, you know, the governor's Republican, all the statewide office holders are Republican. Both houses in the legislature are Republican. And Trump won Ohio big time back in 2016. And I was as surprised as anybody. In fact, I was a commentator on one of the local TV stations when the word came in that Hillary had lost. And I was visibly shocked by that. But as I thought about it, looking back at it in hindsight, I understood why. Because Hillary had a playbook that was not the playbook that we had etched out for him.
And does Biden have that playbook?
I hope he does. I'm having conversations with his people.
And what is it?
Well, the playbook is, under the new COVID environment, it's a harder playbook to execute. But it still amounts to the same thing. Having presence in Ohio matters. It's not just putting money on TV. It's having presence. And no, you can't have big crowds and like that in the COVID campaign scenarios, but having a presence here is going to matter. If it means having small clutches, if it means, you know, being in some neighborhoods, if it means having a bus come through, whatever works under the COVID environment needs to happen. And people pay attention. It's like Iowa, you know, presence matters. Secondly, Ohio's kind of divided into three parts. Northern Ohio's very Democratic, and it's about turnout for Democrats. Southern Ohio is very Republican, and it's about turnout for Republicans. Central Ohio, where Columbus is located, along with other suburban communities, is persuasion territory. And so I can tell you when Obama ran in 2012, Obama and his opponent, Mitt Romney, came to Columbus 77 times in that election year, each of them.
Wow.
Combined, 77 times. And because we're the center of communications and politics for Ohio, and you know the reach communication wise is big here.
Let me just try one more and then turn it over to James. And that is Ohio. At one reason Trump won, you have a large number of white, non-college educated, working class voters who went overwhelmingly for Trump. And it used to be, I remember the Democratic Party chair out there one time telling me when he looked at the election night maps, he would get Pennsylvania envy. And I would say, why? He said, because they have all those big populous blue suburbs. And we don't have those kind of suburbs. With Franklin County now, is that an offset? Is your suburban vote growing to the extent it offsets that other vote that Trump tends to do better?
So the suburban communities, you know, they can be Democrat. They're always on the cusp. And the reason I think why we lost in 2018 in the governor's race is because we spent an enormous amount of time in urban areas, which is great. You know, it's good for turnout. But our suburban areas were left pretty much untouched, in my view. And so I think the suburban areas around Columbus, the counties around Columbus, you know, we could dig deep and we may not win them, but we could win a lot more than, you know, we can get up to 2012 levels in those counties. So the suburban communities play a role in a Biden victory. I think we could, if we don't win them, we could dig deep into Democratic territory in those suburban counties where they become they go from red to purple. Outside of Cleveland, outside of Cuyahoga, outside of Franklin County, up in Delaware, other suburban counties. And we didn't do that. Our strategy was totally focused on the urban areas. And I think Biden needs to focus on some of those suburban areas. And I think he can pull enough votes to get all over the finish line.
So Mayor, the Biden campaign calls you, just this hypothetical, and says, look, we've got a visit to Ohio scheduled 3 days before the election. Mayor, what do you think we should? Should we go to Cuyahoga and Cleveland and get the vote out? Should we do Columbus? Should we maybe try to cut into the margin in southern Ohio? What scheduling recommendation would you give them 3 days before the election on their visit to Ohio?
I think you got to go both Cleveland and central Ohio, northern and central Ohio. Central Ohio being that entire swath in the middle, not just Columbus, but you know, outside, get some of those suburban areas. Columbus is going to vote for Biden. Franklin County is going to vote for Biden. Cuyahoga is going to vote for Biden. I think some of those folks who are kind of like sitting in the middle, that are on the bubble, you know, and those folks live in the middle Ohio. So the persuasion folks are in the middle. Southern Ohio, I wouldn't write them off. But I would say spend some time in Athens, spend some time in some of these suburban communities outside of Columbus and outside of Cleveland.
So just to look a little bit forward here to 2022 in Ohio, the Portman seat is going to be up. Is there any maneuvering or jockeying on the Democratic side that, or who are people looking at as potential 2022 Democratic Senate candidates in Ohio?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think there are a couple of mayors, one out of Dayton, one out of Cincinnati, that are looking at statewide office. Both of them are looking at the governor's office. The governor's extremely popular. Mike DeWine, extremely popular among both Democrats and Republicans. So we'll see how all that plays out. But one of those two may go after Portman's seat, potentially, because it is a statewide office. I know both of them are now currently looking at the governor's office. And I doubt if there's going to be a primary between the two.
So people sometimes have a view of Ohio being a big industrial state. Of course, to an extent, it really is. But I've noticed, particularly in Columbus and other places, even Dayton, a lot of technology jobs are coming in, kind of with new wave of futuristic jobs. I mean, how do you see Ohio position itself in between a traditional industrial state and a, you know, more forward-looking technology and education-based economy?
I think it is transforming into a technology environment. That's where the growth of jobs are in Ohio, in particular in Columbus. region. Technology has really taken a foothold in our economy. We're not a rust, well, Columbus is not a rust belt city at all. If anything, we need more industrial in Central Ohio, in Columbus. But I think the state is moving more towards technology-based, younger population, at least in Central Ohio. But I think other parts of the state, I think there are some issues, you know, that some of the population is starting to decline in some of the other areas around the state. And they are actually moving to Columbus or outside the state. That is troublesome.
Let me ask you a couple, just going back to the presidential race. I've heard some Democrats worry that that Biden and the party in general, in out of respect for the pandemic and social distancing, are really limiting any ground game, if you will. But the Republicans apparently say the pandemic be damned, and they are far more active. But I also hear that the mail ballots are coming in heavily Democratic. What's the trade-off there? And do you have any worries about a lack of a ground game, or is that now moot?
I think there needs to be a ground game, but not the kind of ground game you're seeing that ignores COVID. And the ground game, you know, is people know if you're in the region, and it doesn't have to be, you know, 2,000 people or 20,000 people arm in arm without masks. But I think smaller events are important, and you could do it and recognize that there's a pandemic here. And I think the Biden campaign, I think they are starting to do more of that. You can't do the irresponsible thing that the president is doing, but something much smaller, much more intimate, but the word gets out and it's meaningful. And that's what I would do in Ohio if I were Biden.
Speaking of Biden and Trump, I'm sure you watched the debate last night. What was your take?
Wow. it is probably the most unbelievable thing I've ever seen from a sitting president. And I applaud Biden's restraint, even though, you know, he did say a couple of times, you need to shut up, dude, you're a clown. But, you know, I wanted to say much more. I think what you saw last night is the chaos personality that Trump has. And I think it's largely contributing to why he's going to lose Ohio. In Ohio, character counts. And I don't think the first time around, people in Ohio realized that they were going to elect a fool for a president. And I think that Ohio is largely turning the corner for Biden. It's for Biden too, but Trump's character is such that I think he's crossed the line so many times in so many ways. And last night was a demonstration of a man who you don't know when he opens his mouth if he's telling the truth. Well, you know he's not telling the truth when he opens his mouth.
Well, he only lies when he does open his mouth, Mr. Mayor.
Yeah. Every time he opens his mouth, there's a lie coming out of it. It was incredible. I mean, some of the stuff, it was even comical. My wife and I were looking at it. We just cracked up laughing when he talked about the billions of trees that he was planting around the nation to address climate change. It sounded something straight out of a Saturday Night Live skit. I don't think it was the most unbelievable thing I've ever seen in my life from a sitting president. And our nation should be embarrassed to have a guy like him as the president on an international stage and on a local stage. He had a chance to address white supremacist groups, and he didn't. He gave him a pass again. It gave you every reason in the world to understand that that it would be much worse if the guy were elected for another 4 years. This is what you're going to get for the next 4 years.
Oh, perish that thought, Mr. Mayor. James, you've got one or two more, I know.
You know, one of the more nationally prominent Ohio Republicans is former Governor John Kasich. And he certainly anti-Trumper, endorsed Biden, a lot of his people are. Is Kasich going to be some help to get some votes in Ohio for Biden? Will that have an impact, you think?
I think it will. I think it will to those Republicans who find the conduct of Trump repulsive, his racist comments repulsive. He's the great divider, not the great uniter. He wants to be president of the divided states of America rather than the United States of America. And he's the reason for it, the division. I think Kasich can bring along moderate Republicans who put country before party. And he'll have an impact there. And that's another reason why I think Biden can win in Ohio.
I also noticed that the former Speaker of the House, John Boehner, said, I'm not getting in the middle of this. Are there any other kind of prominent establishment Ohio Republicans that are, if not endorsing Biden, just kind of staying out of the fray that you can think of?
Well, I know, I won't mention names, but I know many in the business community that weren't really particularly happy with Hillary, that held their nose and voted for Trump. The last go round is no way they're going to vote for Trump this go round and have made it public and talked about it publicly and among themselves. I've been in a room with some of them. And, they may have voted for Trump the first time, but no way would they vote for him this time. And a lot of business leaders, a lot of community leaders, rational Republican leaders, moderate Republican leaders are saying underneath their breath, they are no way going to support this man this time. They have to vote for the country and not for this goofball.
A mayor in a place like Columbus, which is, got a large, diverse, and, the stuff he did, you can't do that without working with a lot of different constituencies. And, when you look at what Trump does, this divisiveness and this utter inability to talk to 60% of the country, I got to tell you, I've been out there, and last night I've just hardened my views that people are going to be surprised on the upside as to how big the result's going to be when the votes are counted in this election. I really mean that. I just think it was striking how little he tries to get anybody other than people that are already totally committed to him to vote for him. I've never seen anything like it in politics in my life.
Yeah, he hasn't do a very good job, nor does he care about expanding his base.
Right.
His base is his base. He's playing to his base. The idea of expanding it is not on his agenda. He doesn't care about expanding his base. And, so that's fair game for Biden. So, he's staying with his 40%, 38%, whatever it is. But I tend to agree with you that if the Biden campaign invests resources and time and energy into Ohio, they can win Ohio and keep it away from Trump. And I think the rest of the country will follow along. This is, has become a red state, but I think this red state can turn into move back to a purple state if Biden does the right things in the state, invest, spend the time, do all those things necessary to pull this state. And I'm encouraging them to do so. And I agree with you, James, that if they can pull Ohio, I think this will be a landslide victory for Biden nationwide.
Well, I'll turn back over to Al, make the general point. It you know, Ohio is, just one of the more critical American states. And I think it would really help Biden to be able to say that he carried Ohio. I think it would give him some momentum and some political strength going into which is obviously going to be a very tough job he has. And I think Ohio's important, certainly in the electoral votes are critical, but its symbolism, I think, is really important to bring together a big political coalition that he's going to need. So I hope everybody gets the job done there. Over to you, Albert.
I agree totally. And who knows, it might even put some spine back in Rob Portman, although that may be uphill. Mr. Mayor, you have been terrific. Thank you so much. I told you before we went on the air that I first came to Columbus to cover politics in 1974, and you couldn't wait to get out. Right now, if it weren't for COVID-19, I couldn't wait to get back. You have created one of the most sparkling, happening cities, young people, great restaurants, hotels. Columbus, Ohio is really one of the true gems of American cities. So thank you for being with us, and congratulations on what you've done.
Thank you, and I welcome you back to the great city of Columbus. And Raging Cajun, I'm always glad to be with you. You're one of the great political minds in the history of this nation, and I'm glad to see that you're spending time and you're thinking on what's going to happen in Ohio in this race.
Well, thank you very much, man. It means a lot to me coming from somebody like you to just accomplish so much in their life and, really brought around a great city. And we'll be keeping our fingers crossed and we'll be looking at Ohio. And, like I say, hopefully we can bring this puppy home. So good luck to you.
We'll stay in touch. Thank you very much, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you.
Hey, James, our next guest, Benjamin Ginsburg, has overcome a lot. His prep school education, he and I both went to the Haverford School a few years apart, and his professional start, he was a newspaper reporter before he made good. He went on to become the best political campaign lawyer I have ever dealt with, even though I probably voted against most of his candidates. Ben is smart, he is politically attuned, and he is always honest. He stepped down as a partner at Jones Day, a law firm, a few months ago, and now he's a CNN contributor, a lecturer, and we can call him Professor Ginsburg. Hey, Ben, thanks for being with us.
Al, James, great to be with you. Love that introduction.
Tell your wife. Listen, Donald Trump has railed against mail voting. He did it in the debate the other night. He does it constantly. You have written, this is wrong, and it's a big mistake. It's going to hurt Republicans.
I think it is. The proof of widespread ballot fraud just doesn't exist. And so by talking about it in the way that he has, he, number one, is depressing Republican turnout in mail ballots, which is something that in many, many states, Republicans have really mastered and relied on to win elections. And then in the short term, he's not so short term, he's putting Republican senators in a really odd position with the confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. He's going to force the Republicans who are litigating voting cases in the different states to actually prove fraud. There's going to be a spotlight on whether that fraud exists to uphold their cases. And lastly, if it comes right down to it and there is a Republican incumbent or Republican candidate who's holding on to a narrow post-election lead, then the president's charges of the election being rigged and fraudulent will be wrapped around the neck of that Republican candidate who's holding on to a narrow lead.
Well, I think you're right, and I can give you a very simple explanation, which I know you already know, which is that Donald J. Trump doesn't give a goddamn about that Republican candidate. All he cares about is himself, and I think that's why he's doing it. But let me, you know, I talked to Michael McDonald this morning, Ben, who is, as you know, one of the great voting experts. He's now at the University of Florida. He said as of this morning, I think, 1.7 million mail ballots are in. I said, well, that's a lot. How does that compare to 4 years ago? He said at this time, 4 years ago, there were 40,000. And they are overwhelmingly coming from Democrats. They are not only asking for it more than Republicans, they're sending them in. And I think that's a direct product of Donald Trump.
Yeah, you'd think there was a pandemic going on or something. It's true. Republicans are being discouraged from voting by mail. And I mean, as you and James certainly know, if Election Day features bad weather or the coronavirus has spiked, people are more reluctant to go to the polls live and in person. The president's trying to push his voters into voting in person. It's a potential mistake. You'd always rather have your votes in the bank.
Yeah, because you don't have to then go back to those people to see if they're going to vote. Every vote that comes in by mail is money you don't have to spend. You can spend on something else.
Yeah, and you know it in advance, so you don't have to send them a lot of communications in the lead up to the election.
Just one more thing, and then I turn it over to James, who really is almost as expert as you are on this. And that is, you mentioned Republicans had mastered this. And not just, that's not the distant past. That special election in California last year for a congressional seat, the Republicans got more mail ballots than the Democrats did. I just don't think this has become a partisan divide in the past.
Yeah, and nobody has asked the president to really explain his reasoning behind it. And maybe a magic reason exists. And if it does, if there's some logic, it'd be good to know it and get it out there.
So, Ben, I was doing campaigns, and you're roughly the same generation as we are. I used to complain, like the Republicans, they just beat the crap out of us with these absentee votes, and they got, and I would like bitch to the campaigns. But I recall, that was considered to be almost universally a Republican advantage in campaigns. We didn't think, no one thought it was like crooked or anything. They it was just assumed, I think correctly, that y'all were better at this kind of stuff than we were.
Yeah. First of all, by the way, I'm much younger than you two.
But I'm gonna get your yearbook picture out.
don't do that. But you know, one of the first recounts I ever did was Connie Mack's Senate race in Florida, 1988. And Connie Mack was behind. He was trailing on election night, but everyone knew that there were lots of absentee ballots to be counted. And by the time they counted all the ballots, Connie Mack had a large and unassailable lead and became a U.S. Senator. It was an example of Republicans doing absentee ballot programs really well. The national parties took notice of that, made sure that Republican state parties had good absentee ballot programs going forward. And it's something that Republicans have done well to this day.
So let me look a little forward. Let's just assume for the moment that I'm right, and this election turns out to be a massive defeat for the Republicans, and Biden does quite well. How do you see the Republican Party going forward? You know, because we, you know, obviously in my life, the Democrats, we've had some, you know, terrible defeats at 72, you know, being, you know, traumatic, 80, 16 being trauma like you couldn't believe. And different parties are going to react to defeats in different ways. But how do you think the Republican Party will regroup and push itself forward? It's obviously going to be around, and it's going to be a lot of different factions competing for primacy. And I just want you to look ahead. Just assume that I'm right for the moment. Maybe I'm wrong, but if I'm wrong, we'll have a different result. But let's just assume this is a big election. Democrats win the Senate. Biden, you know, wins 350 plus electoral votes, and we go from there. Where do you see the party regrouping?
Well, it's a great existential question. So to play out your question, I think that undoubtedly there will be a gigantic circular firing squad for probably 18 months. as different factions of the party, conservatives, Trumpians, moderates, all kind of take swipes at each other with blame on who lost the election. I think that as the 2022 midterms come into play, you would look to history and the fact that the in-power party loses big in the midterms. So whoever is leading House Republicans at that point and Senate Republicans at that point can look for a pretty good election in 2022. It's not a great Senate map, but it's doable. And the House has been subject to a lot of shifts, although that will be the first election under the new lines, the new redistricting. But let's assume that Republicans do pretty well in the midterm elections, as history would suggest. That puts aside the circular firing squad, and then you will have a very large competition to be the Republican nominee in 2024. There are a lot of sort of up-and-coming conservatives in the Senate, in governorships. There'll probably be some rich folks who try it. Some may try and be Trumpian. Some may try and forge a new conservatism. Some may try and rely on the old three-legged stool conservatism. But whoever manages to fight his or her way through the 2024 Republican presidential primary will be the one who sets the tone for the Republican Party going forward.
Well, like also you're going to have the backdrop. It's, you know, I'm going to be ahead of myself, but it seems to be highly likely that if Biden is elected, he probably won't run for the election in 2024. And I just don't buy it. Everybody's going to get out of Kamala Harris's way. I think there's going to be a massive 2024 fight for the Democratic nomination. And that will be played against the backdrop of what is almost certain to be a massive fight for the Republican nomination. And it's history is hard to game out at that point, to say the least.
Yeah, it sure is. I mean, you would not, looking at how the Democrats would recover from the Trump victory, you would not have immediately thought of a 78-year-old, 48-year D.C. veteran rising to the top. And I don't know how to predict Republicans in 2024 either better.
Yeah, and the thing about it is won it easily. I mean, didn't just win. I mean, had a couple of the earlier primaries, but I mean, once James Clyburn dropped the hammer, it was over.
Yeah.
It's really a stunning thing to see. Biden didn't even have literally had no campaign other than Clyburn. And once he won South Carolina, the whole party fell in the line. And I think that was a direct result of 2016.
Right. And, you know, originally, if you were looking at the calendar, you never would have thought that a victory in a South Carolina primary could get digested quickly enough to have the massive Super Tuesday effects that it did just 4 days later. That's not the way things have traditionally worked.
If you just look at like Fairfax in Virginia, but I bet you the Monday before the South Carolina primary, Biden was running at 5%. Mm-hmm. And then they have the election, I guess, on the Saturday, and then you go
Saturday.
Yeah, you go on a Tuesday, and he just wins it going away.
Yeah.
I mean, it was phenomenal. It just wasn't even close.
Why we can't help ourselves about predicting these things.
Well, I'll tell you something, Ben Ginsburg. If James's scenario is right, and it may well be, and you have a bloodbath in the Democratic primary for president and a bloodbath in the Republican primary for president, you know what you need to do? Go back to your roots and go back to being a reporter, because it'll be a great story to cover.
You're absolutely
wonderful.
Right.
Let me ask you just a couple more questions about this. First of all, on the fraud issue, look, there's always been a little bit of voting fraud. There was one in the Republicans in that North Carolina district in 18. And Mo Udall once said when he dies, he wants to be buried in Chicago so he can keep voting. But it really has been rare. And it seems to me proof of that is not any other studies, but Trump appointed his own commission chaired by Mike Pence and Chris Kobach, and they had to disband because they couldn't find many examples of fraud.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true. So fraud has always been a more of a rhetorical argument In other words, you need to have people in the polling places to root out the fraud that is undoubtedly taking place. And, you know, I think it's a good idea to have poll watchers as provided in state law in all polling places, just to either stop fraud if anyone sees it, or to validate that there was no fraud by the absence of any reports. So the president's mention in the debate of poll watchers is actually a good thing. If the poll watchers act too aggressive, which is what he might also have been suggesting, that's when you start getting into troublesome things.
So if I commit election fraud and I get 100 votes, there's a real risk I'm going to go to jail for 10 years. I mean, it's not a very the profit for what you can accomplish by versus the risk seems to be legally a real gulf. I mean, it's for a little bit you can get into a lot of trouble. Is that generally true of election law?
Well, I think it is. I mean, it's something people get very wrapped up in it and sometimes do things that are not terribly smart. If you were to find something amiss, you've got processes in every state for litigating it. And the truth is, when there is the sort of scattered fraud that's been discovered, it tends to be over local races where, as we all know from politics, things can get a little more fevered than can happen in any other arena. So, yeah, I do think that's a fair point.
You know, I'm going to call and turn it over to Alan. I've worked in a lot of different countries, a lot of different races. And I have to tell you, I've polled in, Nigeria and Brazil and Indonesia, and you name it. I have never really been surprised by an election outcome. I'm who am I to say that there's not voter fraud in a lot of these, in the global south or some of these places? But I just got to tell you, it's not that big of an issue in Colombia. People really kind of assume it's going to be a fair election. And from every piece of evidence I see, Mexico, I can't tell you that it doesn't exist, but I've never seen a result where I was going, this makes no sense at all. And I think that voter fraud worldwide I think people presume it exists more than it actually does. Now, I'm not talking about a place like Russia, where you can't vote, but I'm talking about kind of clumsies, starting, ineffective democracies. I worked in Afghanistan, and I think they actually had a decent vote count there. I really do.
Well, look, we've had a history in the U.S. back in the old days, starting with Tammany Hall. There may have been a few examples in Louisiana every now and again when ballot boxes appeared stuffed. So again, the parties and the candidates looking out for fraud and having people in the polling places, both for the casting and counting of ballots, is part of the safeguards in the system. But it's when you make unsubstantiated claims that the underlying elections are fraudulent that you start to do damage to the system baselessly.
Yeah, I mean, there was been here long, Leander Perez, who was an awful man, but he ran the Plaquemines Parish, which is where the Mississippi River goes in. It's kind of the long thing where the Mississippi River goes into the Gulf of Mexico. It's the election night. He said, somebody tell a son of a bitch to stop counting. We already won. Because they would hold out the boxes, to see how many votes you needed, and they could produce them.
I thought you were going to tell the story of the Louisiana parish that sold its voting machines down to a state in Mexico, and the next year Edwin Edwards got elected governor of that state in Mexico.
That, I'll tell you something, that is very believable. There also was the great, supposed telegram, apocryphal though it was, that Joe Kennedy sent his son Jack about West Virginia, don't buy one more vote than necessary. I ain't paying for a landslide. So, listen, this is Ben Ginsberg. It is always delightful to talk to you. You have overcome the Haverford School and being a reporter and had just an extraordinary career, and you're going on to do some fun and great things now. And let's just stay in touch, okay?
And come back to my house in Yonge, Ben. I just told you.
I would love to do that. That was truly fun. Give my best to Mary and Judy.
I will. And thank you so much for coming on the show. It was a terrific guest that has terrific insight that our listeners and subscribers need to hear. So thanks a million, man. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Okay, thanks for listening. And next week, we're going to try something new. Send us your questions. We'll see if we can answer them. So just send them to politicswarroom@gmail.com. That's politicswarroom@gmail.com. And send all the tough ones to James. I'll take the easy ones.